I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Greetings, listeners. This is part one of a two-part episode about American policy and the rise of China. Now, the irony is that even though Rob and I nattered on for so long that we decided we needed to divide this episode into two different podcasts, we still don't even begin to answer some of the questions that we posed at the outset. This means that in the future, we're going to do more episodes on this particular topic. But for now, I hope you enjoy what we have. Hi, I'm Dan Nexon.
Hey, this is Rob Parley.
And today, it sounds like we're going to be talking about the rise of China, and particularly a couple of questions related to that. What is the implication of China's continued rise for international order and American leadership, and why the United States has not pursued a policy designed to forestall the rise of China are kind of the two big questions that I think you want to talk about. Is that correct?
Right. And I guess the third big question is sort of, you know, granting that the rise of China is a thing that is going to happen. What steps does that imply for U.S. policy for future management of the liberal international order, right? So what steps should the United States take now that will accommodate the rise of China? And what steps can the United States take down the road when the Chinese economy is 4/3 the size of the U.S. or 5/3 the size of the U.S. And China is taking an ever greater role in the managing institutions?
Okay, so let's start with the question of how did we get here, right? And the puzzle that, that you've raised and you've been writing about, I think, which is why didn't the United States more proactively take steps to say, you know what, if China grows continuously at a 7 to 10% rate, the Chinese economy will overtake the American economy, and that could mean the emergence of a new peer competitor, particularly in a period, the 90s, in which the United States doesn't have a peer competitor and has enormous geopolitical leverage in principle to take steps to prevent the emergence of peer competitor. In fact, if you look at, say, the Project for the New American Century,
right,
or other prominent pro-hegemony pro-hegemony movements, the primary goal of those people is to forestall the emergence of a peer competitor. And yet, here we are. So, what do you think happened?
I mean, it's a pretty good question. I mean, one, I think that some of these institutions, like the Project for a New American Century and so forth, never came up with a good sort of plan for how the rise of China would be forestalled, right? I think that there are probably two things going on. On the one hand, there was sort of the blissful optimism following the fall of the Berlin Wall that the Chinese Communist Party was simply not long for this world, right? I mean, you know, even in the middle of 1989, it appeared for some time as if the CPSU would survive the CCP, and that became obviously not the case in the 1990s, but there was, you know, a degree of the same optimism that people have had and don't really have anymore with respect to the collapse of North Korea. But there was sort of an optimistic liberal idea that, in fact, what would happen in China would be something like the Soviet Union, and then China would become either sort of atomized or cuddly in the sense of, you know, becoming a liberal democracy. And that was, there was a lot of poor thinking along those lines that wasn't really well structured, but it militated against an economically aggressive response to China. And the second thing is that even by the early 1990s, the U.S.-China relationship, the economic relationship, was becoming really extremely important in the United States to a variety of different interest groups. And in some sense, sort of saying no to the increasing economic integration of the United States and China would have been extraordinarily costly in a way that even the containment of the Soviet Union was not costly, right? Just because of how tightly the economies were becoming integrated, right? So, I mean, that's sort of my thinking about why this never happened, even if it could have happened, which may not have been the case, but why there wasn't an aggressive response.
It would certainly be interesting to go back to the debates of the early 90s. So we're in the post-Tiananmen era. So people, my wife likes to do a parlor game. where she asked people where the largest anti-regime protests were in the late 1980s. And, you know, people usually answer the Soviet Union, or maybe they say East Germany, but in fact it's in China.
Right.
That you have the most widespread, and it's not just Tiananmen Square, there are widespread protests in China, large mobilization against the regime. And for a time, it's not clear what the outcome of that is going to be. It looks like the military might defect. Certainly some high-ranking members of the Communist Party do not want to crack down on the protesters, and ultimately they do crack down. And that in a fairly massive way.
Right.
And that leads by the early 90s to a debate between those who want to do permanent most favored nation status for China, which would allow the continued integration of the U.S. and the Chinese economy by giving China essentially the same trade posture as anybody else with the United States, you know, the best possible trade relationship in terms of access to U.S. markets. And those who are saying that the United States shouldn't do this, largely, while a lot of those, a lot of the reasons are economic, right, the labor unions and other groups that don't want Chinese competition, much of the debate is also cast in terms of human rights, right, and Chinese human rights abuses. Now, ultimately, we know the outcome of this, which is that under the Clinton administration, the U.S. extends a permanent MFN to China. Is it permanent, or does it have to be renewed still?
I mean, I think it's permanent, right?
Right.
You now have to take active steps to sort of prevent it.
So it's no longer, you know, that we renew the trade relationship through a contentious process every period. And a lot of people think that's the turning point, when really now Chinese growth is set on the path that we now see, because that means that all of these American companies go in and start getting their manufactured goods from China. They also start transferring technology to China in order to cheaply produce those same goods in China. And that really, according to some, accelerates the bleed out of the United States. Now, there is this data that suggests that automation and productivity gains might be driving U.S. losses in the manufacturing sector more than trading relationships. I'm not qualified to really sort that out,
I think it's secondary. That may or may not be true, but it's secondary to the question we're dealing with right now, I think.
Right, because even if those trends had happened, it's not clear that China would have been a major beneficiary of trade. It could have been Mexico could have done much better, for example, or other markets that had trade relations with the United States could have done much better compared to China. Right. So this is a big inflection point. And you're exactly right. I think that the bargain, the sort of way that this gets legitimated is this assumption that trade, you know, relations with China are pretty good anyway, certainly in the early 90s. They're still, you know, part of the anti-US, anti-Soviet alliance system that had existed. They're not, you know, they're still strategic partners of the United States. Or there's still that hangover. And then also just this fable that if we trade with China, it will build a middle class, and that will build liberalization. And so, yes, they might have missed the chance to transition Soviet style or Eastern European style, but now they will transition more gradually and probably more peacefully, was the argument.
Right, and there's another thing going on, you know, with this argument, with sort of this kind of blissful assumption that even if that happened, right, even, you know, the Chinese Communist Party divides in two, and suddenly it's a Democratic Party and a Republican Party, and they're Democratic, and there's kind of a blissful assumption, and then they're going to be okay with U.S. global leadership and still not want to change all the institutions, right? You know, as if just being Democratic is not going to make them interested in sort of altering the deal in Darth Vader's terms, right?
And it's interesting there, because in the early 1990s, the mid 1990s, we already have arguments that say that if the rise of China is like the rise of Wilhelmite Germany, then it might be more dangerous if China is democratizing, because then the parties will engage in nationalist outbidding. They will be more conflict prone with the United States and with their neighbors, precisely to gain political abilities. There's even references to the so-called Iron Rye Coalition in Wilhelmite Germany developing in China. So you have a fusion of economic and military interests that drive a more aggressive China. So it's not at all clear that democratization leads to a peaceful East Asia, even in the 1990s. So yeah, there's that additional, I think you're exactly right, there's that additional assumption.
Right. And so, you know, all of this comes together in various ways to, you know, I mean, so the United States does take some steps to prevent, you know, very specific development of Chinese capabilities, right? You know, there are export controls that the United States facilitates, both for itself and for the European Union, with the transfers of some military technologies and some dual-use technologies. But even then, right, the U.S. investment and European investment in China is huge, and it's accompanied by this technology transfer that simply would have been unthinkable with respect to the Soviet Union. And, you know, we could go back and quibble about Germany and Japan way back when, but would have been purely unthinkable with respect to the Soviet Union in the 1940s or the 1950s, right? So taking active steps to make the Chinese economy more productive in a way that sort of sets this great power competition question to the side.
Are the United States and make it increasingly difficult for the United States to take actions short of trying to prevent some critical technologies from being produced in China.
Right, and you know, I mean, just to pause here and say that it's not, you know, it's not, we're not hard-hearted people, and it's not all about dollars and cents, although, you know, pretty much it's all about dollars and cents, right? You know, on the one hand, the United States has a long-standing romantic vision of the Chinese people, right, that goes back to the late 19th century, that would make sort of taking active steps to ensure the continued impoverishment of the Chinese countryside problematic from an ideological point of view, right? However much you can make sense of it from a strategic point of view, that, you know, there are long-standing trends in how the United States views China, perhaps not the PRC in particular, but sort of China writ large, that would militate against sort of these kinds of active steps.
And I would also say that on the if you are of the belief that trade is liberalizing and that ultimately China will evolve or be nudged into being a more liberal, more democratic society, and if you believe the kind of democratic peace hypothesis, which was certainly what a lot of our policymakers paid lip service to, then you would think that would lead, you know, that would avoid confrontation, right? Democracies
right.
don't fight one another; they aren't rivalrous with one another.
Right, right, and even, I mean, you don't even have to go all the way to democracy, right? If you believe in interdependence arguments about conflict prevention, which certainly many of our policymakers believed in the 1990s.
And I think that actually, if you look at the kinds of news stories, and so this you talked about the romantic view of the Chinese people, and the way this has a long-standing valence in the United States.
Right.
I think that there's a broader phenomena, which is that the, you know, sort of built into American exceptionalism, ironically, is the idea that if you scratch the surface on anybody, they're really kind of an American liberal
right.
Democrat waiting to get out, small L, small D Democrat, not you know, a Dukakis supporter, but
right.
And you know, that same attitude helped to legitimate the Iraq War and the view that nation building would be easy and all that kind of thing. But I would say that if you kind of look at the stream of news and the evidence, really, even until fairly recently, China kind of looks like a success story, right, for that kind of less ambitious narrative. You know, China is, you know, does seem to be opening up. There is more room for not challenging the party, but for dissent and for voice opportunities. If you are a businessman and you go hang out with Chinese business people, you know, it feels increasingly like an open consumer society. It looks kind of like the United States. There's lots of advertising, lots of consumer goods, American brands, Chinese brands that you recognize because you're now buying them in the United States. And so up until very recently, I think there was some surface plausibility to this idea that while it wasn't going as fast as some Americans would like, you know, that it wasn't going to happen through democratization, but it might happen, Andrew Nathan argued, through democratization in the Chinese party, so it would be kind of like the LDP. That looked
right.
like a pretty good story up until really quite recently.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, and I wonder if what has happened has really been not so much a change in the way that China's behaved, although, you know, I think we can agree that there are some sort of useful, notable disjunctures between Comrade Xi and his immediate predecessors with respect to both domestic and foreign policy. But rather sort of, and this is perhaps more Russia-driven than it is even China-driven, an evolving sense of what an authoritarian country is, right? And of what authoritarianism in the modern world looks like, right? So you can tell this story about sort of China's slow evolution to becoming a liberal-ish democracy or no, a liberalish not democracy, right? You know, you could, maybe even like Frederick II or something like that, but or Singapore, for example. Let's throw that out. But as you know, sort of our thinking about authoritarianism and about the durability of authoritarianism and authoritarian states in the 21st century has, I think, taken a turn over the past 5 or 10 years to, you know, the perspective that, you know, maybe these authoritarian countries are actually coming up with pretty interesting ways to survive. And they can look in some ways like, you know, having something that approaches democratic civil society and yet remain quite authoritarian in their politics. And so I wonder if it isn't so much China has changed as we have changed our view of what authoritarianism, of what modern authoritarianism looks like.
That might be the case. You could also tell a somewhat different story, which goes something like this. In the 90s, the United States believes itself to be the unipolar colossus that stands astride the world. And looks at China very much through that lens. And it's still going to take a lot of Chinese rapid growth for China to really become anything like a competitor to the United States, even by the end of the 90s. And the United States is still drunk on the first Gulf War in the sense that it has unrivaled military capabilities and the know-how to use those military capabilities, which is going to make it very hard for anybody to catch up. So the United States is pretty complacent, even through, you know, the point of having some fairly serious spats with the Chinese, like when the United States bombs the Chinese embassy during the Kosovo campaign. Which the United States can kind of just brush off because, you know, heck, what are the Chinese really going to do about it?
Right.
When Bush comes to power, I think there is a palpable sense that China might be a future rival. And relations between China and the United States are not great at the beginning of the Bush administration, just as they're not great for periods of time during the Clinton administration. You have the P3C Orion incident,
which
you know, a lot of people see as a Chinese test, and sort of both sides find a way to save face. But this kind of looks like how the future might go. At the same time, the Project for the New America Century people are pushing for the idea that if the United States maintains a huge military power gap, that Chinese growth won't matter so much because they won't be able to ever catch up. And so they're focused on kind of military dominance. But then September 11th
happens.
Which
doesn't really make sense.
Yeah,
I mean, that's honestly never really made sense, has it? I mean, you know, their argument being that the gap was so large, right? I mean, it feels like you just have to just keep running the numbers. And if Chinese growth continues, then forever becomes decades, right? So has that, the sort of gap argument that the PNAC people talk about, does that make sense to you? Has that ever made sense to you?
Well, there are a lot of things here that don't make sense to me. I mean, the PNAC argument essentially was if the U.S. could maintain a large technological and military lead in its capabilities and demonstrate that those capabilities were overwhelming, that you know, while China or other states could, in theory, devote enormous resources to bridging them, they wouldn't bother. They just rather remain prosperous and do their thing than try to divert massive amounts of resources into guns and away from butter or from other types of things. So there is some logic there. It never really made a lot of sense to me. But also, I think, you know, there's a lot of hubris, for lack of a better word, caught up in American thinking in the 90s and even through the 2000s. And one bit of hubris was really, I think, the belief that those technological capabilities, those military capabilities, were just so insurmountable or are so insurmountable, really based on some fairly limited data, right? And the sort of shock value of American combined force operations against the Iraqi military. So I think that we sort of got, you know, I have a grad student who has great dissertation. She's written about this, that, you know, she argues that before the first Gulf War, the United States grand strategy was really oriented towards a resumption of kind of like the Roosevelt four policemen notion, the idea that we would have a new world order in which the great powers cooperated to peacefully solve problems or would engage in multilateral military action. And she argues that the fact that the United States just crushed the Iraqi military and did it with these technologies that we had sort of had since the Vietnam War, but hadn't really come to fruition, that that made the United States really addicted in its grand strategic thinking to the efficacy of military force, and it changed the calculation. Because now the United States thought it could just project force anywhere and crush anybody, and that meant that the emphasis on kind of a more great power concert type relations just fell by the wayside. So there's that hubris. You could dispute that. There's also the hubris of thinking that there was a kind of special sauce in American ingenuity that would mean that we would always come out on top. And this was heavily reinforced by the Japanese experience, by the experience of Japan. Right. So remember, in the late 80s, it was Japan as number one. Japan was going to overtake us. Crichton was writing racist historical novels about Japanese dominating the United States rising sun. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Sean Connery, of course. Right.
And the Japanese were writing books like The Japan That Can Say No, and everybody was expecting future confrontation. Japan was on track to overtake the United States in GDP. And then the Japanese had their decade mired in recession, and the U.S. had the tech boom.
Decade-ish.
Yeah, it was longer than a decade. So the United States had the tech boom, and this reinforced this notion that, well, it may look like other states might catch up to us. It might, you know, but it was all going to be like the Japanese in the 80s or the Soviets in the 50s. It was all going to be an illusory because the United States was just so much better at coming up with new cool things that it would always leapfrog the competition because it was a more liberal economically democracy. The sense was it would also always be able to weather these kinds of shocks and dysfunctions in a way that other states wouldn't be able to. So it's all sorts of wishful thinking about how the United States would always come on top. And you still see that in writings about China today.
It's still there in terms of, I mean, really the entire third offset is in a lot of ways sort of geared around this idea that, no, okay, well, maybe now we really have to try to become more ingenious and so forth. Now that we, you know, by pursuing the right policies, we can ensure for the foreseeable future American technological superiority, which, well, I don't know, right? I mean, the world is a strange place, and technology travels in different ways than it has before. But there's, you know, it doesn't seem likely that the assumptions about American technological superiority are always going to be there, right? I mean, the story of why the United States was technologically superior to the Soviet Union is really a long one and a complicated one, and a lot of the factors don't apply to China in any way to China.
And in fact, what I find fascinating is there are good arguments that the United States has managed to develop a political economy that was particularly conducive to technological innovation. And people point to factors like the higher educational system and its ability to generate critical thinking and entrepreneurial approaches in a way that maybe the Chinese weren't as good at or other countries weren't as good at. People point to the Silicon Valley, venture capital, and certainly the Chinese are trying to catch up on all those things. They're putting massive resources into trying to reproduce a Silicon Valley environment. They're putting massive resources into the educational system. And some people are skeptical because, you know, a combination of authoritarianism and other structural problems make that more difficult for them. But what I always like to say is that, you know, you don't need to go toe-to-toe for the United States on per capita ingenuity or per capita entrepreneurship when you have three times as many people. Right. You can afford a lot more inefficiency and a lot more waste, as it were, because you just need a smaller percentage of people to get it right to have the same kinds of underlying abilities.
And another distinction with sort of the Soviet experience, less so with the Japanese experience, but certainly with the Soviet experience, is that not only was the United States much closer in terms of overall size to the Soviets and had a much larger GDP and so forth, but partially because of U.S. policy and partially because of Soviet policy, the Soviet Union was cut off technologically and economically from the rest of the world, right? It was trying to develop its own system, right? We are well past the time when China can be cut off from the world in any sort of meaningful way, right? And so it's when it was the U.S. against the Soviet Union, it was actually, you know, literally the U.S. and Western Europe and Japan and a large community of innovators working together and transferring technology back and forth and so forth, right? And there's lots of ways this story has been told. But that's not a story we can tell with respect to China, right? I mean, there's investment from every part of the globe, technology-rich investment into China, Chinese investment in other places. And so we don't have the advantage that we established in the 1940s and 1950s over the Soviet Union with respect to China, right? And, you know, maybe part of the story, to drag this back to where we were, is that we didn't take any steps in the 1990s to create that advantage, right? And now it's way too late to try to create it now.
I mean, in fact, you know, there's a question of, I mean, it's very hard to imagine cutting out China now. Right. In fact, it's possible to imagine the long term the U.S. would be a loser from those efforts,
right?
Because certainly it would be very difficult to convince the other innovative rich economies to also do the same. In fact, they would have incentives to do more of it if we pulled out fill in that gap. And it's not like the Europeans have the same kinds, for example, have the same kinds of security concerns about China that the United States does.
Right.
So there's that. There's also the fact that, you know, so I was just in Sydney at the Q workshop, which is an ongoing workshop on quantum technologies and politics. And this was a technologically heavy iteration. I haven't been to the other ones. So we had a lot of scientists who are working on quantum computing. Sydney, University of Sydney is one of the big labs for quantum computing, which is heavily funded by U.S. money, by the way, by the U.S. military. And, you know, one of the things that they were emphasizing is that the basic research on quantum computing is all open, right? And there's an enormous amount of scientific cooperation. A lot of the big Chinese advances have been not even with Chinese scientists. They've been with German scientists, and they've been in collaboration with international scientists. So it's a globalized scientific community that's working on a lot of these kinds of technologies. So it's very hard to imagine how you would unravel that. It looks a bit more like the 19th century.
Right.
And then it looks like this period in which you had globalized liberalism that excluded the major pole, you know, the other pole, right?
Right.
So in that sense, yeah, it's very difficult to imagine recreating those conditions. And yet it's easy in retrospect to see the way in which the United States and U.S. thinkers and policymakers misread those complicated structural conditions as being somehow evidence for U.S. exceptionalism on the technological side.
Right.
You know, overemphasized the fact that the United States, that every other major, that all of the other largest economies the U.S. had set up political hierarchical relationships with at the beginning of the Cold War, Germany, Japan, France, et cetera, were U.S. allies and often junior partners. And even though some of them, like France, might push away from the United States, at the end of the day, this was a global liberal community, and one that it still had technological controls and stuff. I don't want to downplay that you're an expert
right,
on
right.
that. But nonetheless, I think, yeah, so it's very clear that there are profound misreadings of the possibilities that China might emerge as a serious competitor for the United States, and a consistent wishful thinking and downplaying of those possibilities. So on the one hand, it's never going to happen, really. On the other hand, well, even if it happens, it's not going to be a problem because they're going to kind of be liberalized and more
they're
democratic.
Gonna be cuddly. They're going to be very happy. They're panda bears and so forth. So.
Right. So here we are today, where the Chinese economy in PPP terms is larger, purchasing power parity terms, which I think can be overstated, the importance of that. I think nominal GDP
right.
matters a lot more than a lot of people who hype the PPP numbers think, is larger than the United States. Is on track to be larger, has big structural problems. It's funny. We talk a lot about structural problems in the Chinese economy, and when we do that, we tend to forget there are big structural problems in the American economy as well. So there is this kind of confirmation bias where we focus on the Chinese banking sector has huge problems, or the shadow economy, or they do show some signs of what's called the middle income trap
right.
happening. It's just their economy is so big that they can be really wealthy. And yet, the United States, the structure of the U.S. economy is in terrible shape.
Right. Well, I mean, and you know, whatever the problems are with the Chinese banking industry, right, they have not, in very recent memory, crashed the entire global economy based on, you know, a set of, you know, what could have been small scale, but then mushrooming problems within the U.S. housing sector, right? Mm-hmm. And so, And I think you've also touched on this point. We have a tendency to you know, overstate problems that might be emerging with the Chinese political system, right? Because it, you know, it's authoritarian systems do have a fragility to them almost inevitably. But it turns out the U.S. political system's kind of fragile too, right? And it turns out that there are significant ongoing problems, not just structurally with the U.S. economy, but also structurally with the U.S. political system, that in some sense look even less tractable than problems with either the Chinese system more than with the U.S. economy, right? And so, you know, long story short, there's a really big long story. Long story short, we have arrived in a universe where, sort of, as you say, the Chinese and PPP have passed the United States, that it's only a matter of time under even pretty optimistic assumptions about the U.S. economy and pessimistic assumptions about the Chinese economy, that you'll have passing in nominal terms for GDP if it hasn't happened. And where for the past 15 years, China has, you know, undertaken a pretty committed approach to transforming that economic power into military power, which is something it did not do during the 1990s. Shied away from really pretty much up to Gulf War II, is I think when you start seeing the really significant changes in the Chinese military posture, heavy tech investment, heavy sort of overall investment, reorganizations, all this kind of stuff. And so you, now you have a situation where it is very difficult to see anything but the emergence of China as a superpower, right? Something terrible would have to go wrong with the world that is really unexpected to prevent this from happening at this point.
And so before we talk about the implications of that, I think we've pretty well established that, in retrospect, complacency was pretty dumb on the Americans' part. But there was this thing we were talking about before we started up, which is related to that, which is, do we have examples beyond the Soviet Union, short of things that are pretty close to military confrontation or actual great power rivalry, of dominant powers taking really effective steps to forestall the rise of a peer competitor? And I was making the case that we don't really have good examples of that, right? The British are not able to forestall the rise of Germany. The Americans are not able to forestall the rise of Germany and Japan. It takes a world war, in fact, to get rid of the Japanese Empire and to make Germany into a dependent, you know, a sort of security dependency of the United States and full time UK and the UK and France as well. So, sort of in retrospect, we can focus on the particularities of why the United States had its head in the sand, but it doesn't actually seem that unusual that dominant powers have their head in the sand.
You know, as we talked a little bit in the preparatory part, you're right, right? And the other example, and this is the example that in the end may look the most like the U.S. China example, would be the U.S. U.K. example, where the U.K. just takes no useful steps in order to. Which is not to say there weren't people in the U.K. in the end of the 19th century who identified the United States as a threat, because there clearly were. I'm sort of curious, you know.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? It's not only that they take no active steps. The United States, America's spectacular growth in the 19th century is very much a function of British foreign direct investment. There really is a parallel story here. The United States has very cheap labor in a big country. That cheap labor is in a lot of respects through immigrant flows, actually, which makes the, you know, in the U.S. it's external immigration, in China it's internal migration. But in both cases, you know, it's you know, other countries that are growing the United States, and in the U.S. U.K. case, it's the dominant power, the United Kingdom, that creates the conditions under which the United States winds up surprising.
Right. Well, and I would throw in there one other thing, which is that during the 19th century, the United States had a globally notoriously lax attitude towards technology transfer and intellectual property, right, which is one of the main things that we decry in China now, although that's changing in a lot of ways, right? So, but you know what? I mean, and what they did not have in the same way, even in 1950, much less 1930 or 1890, which is not to say that there weren't sort of meaningful communities of sort of strategic thinkers in all of those times, right? But it seems like, and maybe this has something to say about the connection between the U.S. Academy and U.S. policymakers. The United States Academy and international relations thinkers have, over the past 60 years, developed lots of really interesting and nuanced ways of thinking about hegemony, of thinking about power transition, of thinking about polarity, that gives us or ought to give us some tools for how to handle a power transition between two major powers that were kind of not in evidence in the 1990s, or at least were not in evidence in terms of actual U.S. policymaking. And the story here may just be that, look, policymakers just don't ever really listen to academics. But apart from just a few exceptions, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that there was even a ton of sort of really innovative thinking at this time about, you know, ought the United States to take expensive steps to prevent the growth of China, right? I mean, we know what the difference between bipolarity and multipolarity look like. We know how dangerous power transitions are, or at least we have tools that offer them to us. You know, shouldn't this have offered more tools for at least saying that, oh, you know, PNAC is getting basic elements of this question wrong about what China's going to look like in 20 years?
So, but I think this takes us back to the fundamental fact of U.S. foreign policy in the 2000s, which is September 11th and the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. Counterfactually, if there's no September 11th attack, I think this period would have looked very different. The Bush administration was interested in hegemonist policies, that is, in maintaining U.S. Full spectrum dominance. It did, I think, see China as a potential rival and as probably the most salient future peer competitor, even if it could afford to be complacent about that. All of that gets derailed by these quote-unquote small wars, right? By the neoconservative project in the Middle East, and that has a number of effects. Practically, it means that China is at that becomes retooled as, you know, essentially a country whose support we need for our activities, and essentially a country that's also got a counterterrorism problem. Right. They've got, you know, has fears of Islamist terrorism. And so it's more of a kind, you know, there's more of a kind of that changes the nature of that relationship somewhat. Secondly, you know, there's the structural effects. The U.S. spends, you know, $1 trillion over this period in deficit spending to fight these wars that are really kind of grueling for the U.S. military. They reshape the orientation of U.S. military capabilities and acquisition towards counterinsurgency.
Right. I mean, we lose things, you know, fundamental peer competitor capabilities like the F-22 are canceled in favor of ongoing operations and in favor of counterinsurgency and small war themed procurement priorities. Right. So it has a huge impact on what the U.S. military looks like.
Right. And Iraq also, to some degree, punctures the myth of U.S. military supremacy. I mean, ultimately, it turns out a lot of the unipolar moment was perceptual. Right. And once the United States gets bogged down in a war that is really, it's not winning easily, and it's showing it can't actually occupy a nation build very effectively, that has knock-on effects on perceptions of U.S. power on how to deal with it. The other thing is that there's an academic side to the story, because there's already a shift into the study of civil wars in the security field with the end of the Cold War, a sense that
ethnic
great power
conflict,
ethnic conflict, nationalist conflict, and then civil wars in the sense that those are where the action is. That's where people are dying. But also all of, you know, international relations is not a high money field of academic endeavor, right? It's not like a lot of the sciences and technologies. You know, a little bit of money goes a long way in shaping the field. And a lot of money that's pouring into academic international relations is civil war oriented or counterinsurgency oriented in the mid-2000s. And so that has a tremendous effect on what people are studying, what the new data sets are, what where the best talent is going. Right. And so the old guys, right, and they tend to be old guys who are still talking about the rise of China and great power wars and the tragedy of great power politics, John Mearsheimer, they look kind of increasingly obsolescent, right, and weird and unusual in the field in general. And now, of course, this is all coming back. But in a sense, the point is, it's not just a lost decade in terms of U.S. power, in terms of U.S. focus on traditional great power politics. It's also something of a lost decade in our field in terms of studying these kinds of questions. This ends part one of our episode on U.S. policy and the rise of China. If you want to listen to part two, it's already available for download.